Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art Beats and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Hello, and welcome to Good One, a podcast about jokes. I'm your host, Vulture Senior Editor, Jesse David Fox. Each episode, a guest comes on to play a clip of one of their jokes and then discusses how they wrote it and how it fits into what they're trying to do with their comedy. This week's guest is Jamie Demetriou, creator and star of Staff Let's Flats, aka my favorite thing I've watched in like a really, really long time. Though it just premiered in the US on HBO Max, the show has aired two celebrated seasons, or series as they call it in the UK, on Channel 4. In the UK, this summer, Staff Let's Flats won the BAFTA for Best Scripted Comedy, beating Derry Girls, Catastrophe, and, if you can believe it, the second season of Fleabag. Some of you might actually recognize Jamie for his role as Bus Rodent on Fleabag. You know, if you watched Fleabag. If you're not familiar with the show or living in England, I'm sure the title is confusing. It was confusing to me, so I will explain it. So, Staff is the name of the character Jamie plays, a sweet English Greek Cypriot idiot just trying to be cool based on the limited TV and movies he's watched. And Let's Flats means leases apartments. That's what Staff does. He works at a letting agency started by his father. The scene we are going to play is so funny to me, but I think it will help to have some context. So it comes from season 2, episode 5, and the basic setup is Staff has a yearly tradition of getting chips, or French fries, with his younger sister, Sophie. Sophie is played by Jamie's real-life older sister, Natasha, who is an incredibly funny comedian in her own right, who you might know from What We Do in the Shadows. On the show, as in real life, the siblings have an incredibly loving, supportive relationship. It's also notable, Sophie is maybe the only character dumber than Staff. So, chips is the plan until Sophie thinks to invite her new boyfriend, Chem, played by David Mumeni, who besides also being pretty stupid, suggests that instead of getting chips, they get pizza. Sophie's bright idea is that they should make it a double date, and that Staff should invite Katya. Okay, so Katya is Sophie's best friend, roommate, and music-slash-dance partner. She's played by Ellie White, who is Natasha's real-life comedy partner. The whole series up until this point, Staff has been mean to Katya, so when he asks her out, she says no. So he's surprised to see she's there when he shows up. And there's more. See, this is a problem because Staff, needing a date, invited his best friend from the office, Al. Al is just as sweet as the rest of the characters, though slightly less stupid and quite a bit more awkward. Al and Sophie have a bit of a will-they-won't-they thing, or as Sophie tells Staff, when she learns that Al is coming, it's mixed emotions. Al is played by Al Roberts, a comedian Jamie has worked with in the past. Okay, I think that's everything, but to keep track, Chem is the first to talk, then Staff responds, Katya then compliments Staff's outfit, they go back and forth, then the waiter comes. When it comes to order pizza, Sophie's the first to order, and then Al. I think you'll get it. Mostly, I'm so excited for you. I love this show. I want more shows to be like this, silly and nice, but clearly so well thought out. It was a joy to talk to Jamie about it. So, here is Jamie Demetriou.
Thanks for letting me come, because I know maybe everyone thinks I'm a bit dangerous or whatever, and it's a family night, but I only got so much respect for you and your family.
You got good words, innit? I like the way that you have respected me tonight.
By the way, I like your new kit. You look like Desert Prince.
Is it respect to interrupt? Hey, I like your. You got a version, of, different version of hair, small coming up.
Hey guys, have you had a chance to look at the food menu?
Yes, thank you, mate. Oh, you're the waiter?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Thank you. And my compliments for the chef.
From me too.
Steph, you're the best one here, so why don't you order for the whole table? Innit?
Yeah, good. Good choice. Okay, yeah, so we are all going to have the pizza.
Which pizza?
I can't say that for sure.
Oh, can I please eat the cheese and tomato one, Tom cheesy?
And the same for me, please, thanks. And Sophie, you're welcome to a bit of mine if you want to share.
But you order the same one, Tom cheesy.
Connect the burger, then. The pizza, the Tom cheesing.
Do you have a pizza that's half different toppings?
Yes.
I don't want that. I want all the same, beef. Do you have cheddar cheese?
We use mozzarella.
I want goat's cheese, beef pizza, all the same. And maybe you could do one slice, no toppings, but garlic bread slice?
I'm not sure about that.
Just get me some chips.
She knows our food, isn't it?
Can we get pizza and chips?
For me, it seems like this one has sausages and cheeses on it. Can I have that one, or is that one not very nice at all?
It's nice.
Wow. I think I know which one I'm having. It sounds delicious from what he said. So, that one.
Any drinks apart from tap water?
No.
He was very lovely.
Oh, yeah, I loved him.
Yeah, very professional.
The waiter? Ugh, too quiet, shy. I want to get TV remote and just press louder, louder, louder. Louder. Louder.
That's an unusual image, isn't it? Mad. That's very funny. Very, very funny. Well
done. Thank
you.
So I am here with Jamie Demetriou. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me here in my own apartment.
Yes, and me in my own. Though different, very different times. Right? It's nighttime there.
Sure. Oh, right, yeah. How long are you from bed?
Many hours.
Right, okay. I don't talk like that. I don't know what kind of English stereotype I'm trying to uphold.
So I want to talk about this scene. So to sort of get right at it. So the ordering pizza scene, how did it fit into what you're trying to do story-wise and character-wise? And just like, what did you think about ordering pizza would be funny for these characters to do?
Okay. So I suppose I'm often kind of set piece led with the show, as in I try and think what like a funny bracket would be. I mean, I always talk to my producer about trying to find a kind of moment that would be the card in people's head for that episode. It's like if you paused it at any moment in the episode, you'd know which one it was just from that freeze frame. Yeah. Kind of thing. So the idea of them all being sat around eating pizza felt very different. I mean, it seems so inane, but yes. It felt so full of color to me, because I know it's mad, isn't it? It's born out of, actually, we didn't really go, me and my sister, who's in the show, Natasha, we didn't ever really go out for dinner so much when we were little. It was like a real treat if we ever did. And we were sort of not au fait with the rules and the kind of terms and conditions of of having something cooked, not in our kitchen. I don't think I had takeout until I was like 16 or something. And
that's because your dad was a chef?
Oh, no, my mum would generally cook. Oh, cool. In fact, to be honest, me and my sister cooked for ourselves from the age... I was like 11 when I started cooking for myself. But I think it's just a money thing, maybe, or just like it just wasn't a tradition in our house, so we were the ones who had to break it for ourselves. But I remember just so many instances of just like dumb attempts to eat food not in our house. Like, me and my sister went to the US for the first time when we were kids with my mum. She had a kind of meeting thing out there. She gave us like $6 or $7 or something to go and get breakfast together for the two of us. Mm-hmm. Not to be stingy. She just was like, didn't know.
Yeah.
And we went out, and I think I ordered like one sausage. And my sister had cracking up at my own story. My sister, I just haven't thought about this for a while. My sister would have got, I don't know, something, cereal or something. And at the end, she was like, now you don't just pay for the food. You have to give extra monies to the people who work here. Okay, so I'm going to be in charge of that. So we can't spend all the money. We need to save it to do that. Tip. Yeah. And she walked into the kitchen to give them the tip. I remember her, but it's still, this is when I was like 10, and to this day, she'll know what I'm saying if I go, and this is for you, because that's what she said to the chef in the kitchen. Direct to the source. She just didn't want the restaurant to be stealing from the people who work there.
Sure, no, it's very nice.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
But stuff like that, yeah. I mean, the actual like exact sort of reference point for it was, I went to a friend's house. I'll tell a much shorter story here. I went to a friend's house when I was like 17, and none of my friends could like cook or anything. And one of them made a soup, like enough soup for everyone. And they were all kind of like bad boys kind of thing.
Yeah.
Used to just like fucking around and like getting arrested occasionally. And I remember them really taking themselves seriously for this evening, because this soup was being cooked. And they kept, before the soup came to the table, they kept saying, my compliments to the chef.
Got it.
My compliments to the chef. Because it's like the whole of staff is just about a bunch of people saying things they've heard people say in movies and trying to pass them off in their own mouths. And it's like they'd heard people say my compliments to the chef, and it sort of allowed them to feel like grown-ups and not fuck-ups for a second. And I thought there was something quite sweet about that. End of references.
How does the show written? So for those who aren't familiar, here in the States, essentially all sitcoms, even small ones, will have a writer's room of some sort, of at least a few people to larger teams, and they break the stories together, they punch up the stories together. I know there are someone you worked with for the first series, as you would say, or first season, as we would say, but generally, how do you write a show? How do you write a scene like this? Is it all you?
Well, so the last three episodes of season one and season two was all me, and I co-wrote the first three with Robert Popper of series one, who's a brilliant British writer, who wrote a show called Look Around You, which is quite well loved here. He's brilliant. And but yeah, generally, I write on my own. My producer, Seb Barwell, along with Robert Popper, who became script editor of the show, so we'll sort of like read a couple of drafts of it kind of thing, are my kind of sounding walls, and they'll sort of bring me back on the road if I'm veering off and you know, help out. But when I write, I'm completely on my own. Yeah.
I heard you once say that you write phonetically. What does that mean for something like this? Like when you, for the line which is like, is it respect to interact? Are you like writing it out incorrectly?
Yeah, it's written like that, yeah. Interact with a K, yeah.
Can you hear just sort of how all these characters speak in your head? Like, is it a very, you know, like, are you, I feel like there's some visual writing comedy writers and they're sort of more auditory. Like, is it something where you can really, really hear sort of everyone speaking?
I think so, yeah. I think the actors themselves bring so much to it and will more often than not elevate what I have. Mm-hmm. But there is a kind of, the joke more often than not lies in the way that something's said versus what is said. Yeah, I think that there are some that literally don't work if they're not said in a particular way, because the joke is exclusively in how it's said. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's part of the reason it took 1,000 years to get over the line. Mm-hmm. Because I've had to sort of learn, you know, I think this is fine. I think I just had to learn over the years that every stage of script development, be it showing it to the commissioners, you know, showing it to my producer, doing a table read, what for rehearsals, every script kind of has to be different and to suit a different purpose. Mm-hmm. You know, a script that is absolutely perfect on the page, it's sort of been built for that medium kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And you do kind of have to do that, because the people who are financing it and the people who need to understand it need to understand it kind of thing. And I'm sort of more than happy to go through that process now, because it does help you to understand your script better. If you write a script that's like, I tend to kind of build on the sort of auditory, like the stuff that is about tone and delivery tends to mm-hmm. come in the last pass. Yeah.
So much of the scene in the show is really about the characters. You're having five characters that every line they're saying is very much in their line. So I want to talk to you about character very specifically and go through each one. And I want to start with Stath. But sort of I want to ask in general, so we're about the same age. And I feel like in the States growing up, there are a lot of big characters, especially in movies. There's like the Mike Myers movies and the Will Ferrell movies, etc. You know, but like the last 5 to 10 years here, it's sort of dried up outside of sketch. Like you just don't see big characters in the way that you used to. Has a similar right. thing happened for y'all? Do you feel like has comedy become much more realism based? And is the show a response to that? Is the show just, you know, what about it has made you so drawn to doing character comedy?
It's funny, isn't it? Because yeah. I think that that's definitely the case here. But I got to say, you know, when I started writing it, that wasn't so much the case. We still had like Peep Show, and there were still quite a few kind of character, like heavy character things coming out. And then while I was, you know, I was in development for about 6-7 years, and yeah. you know, by the time I got to the sort of fourth, I was like, I don't know if I want to write like a big sitcom anymore. Definitely not about a letting agency. What the yeah. hell am I doing? I don't have a stance on this world. Mm-hmm. Like I really don't have any interest in any of this. And you know, I'd just done Fleabag and that had exploded and I was, you know, and I thought that was brilliant. And you know, I think that it's important to say that I absolutely love, you know, I think that a big part of the turn that comedy's taken is great. You know, there are so many great shows that are, you know, focusing on naturalism, etc. I do think there's a progressiveness to it. I think my issue is the complete absence of the other. Mm. It's like, I mean, I was definitely worried about making it because I was like, do I even stand by this? Do I want to be part of this, you know, how the diversion that's going on? And now that it's out and it's done, I've sort of, you know, over time, obviously it hasn't occurred to me like today, but over yeah. time it's, you know, I am proud. I'm really proud to have a show that's sort of a kind of hard comedy. And yeah. And also what I will say is I've really learned as well, I hope, to attempt to prove that a hard comedy doesn't mean nothing of substance.
Yeah.
Like, I think that there's a tendency to see a comedy drama as a show that keeps its comedy and its drama in separate lanes. Like, you have mm-hmm. your funny bit and then you have your dramatic bit. But I think that some of the moments that I like the most in Stath are where you take something that should be dripping with pathos and just like completely undermine it. But that doesn't mean the pathos is gone. It just means that there's two things happening at the same time.
The thing that, to what you're saying, this thing that I noticed even sort of reading some interviews with you is a thing that I'll notice will happen often with comedy here, which is people or critics who like the show want to find a way to argue it like it's important. You know, like they're to be like, oh, is the show about, they'll ask you if the show's about gentrification or Brexit. And I feel like, and you'll push back a bit. I guess my question is, what do you feel is important about just like, here's a thing that is silly and nice and not use it pejorative? Like it being a thing that is a hard comedy in of itself is an important thing.
Totally, yeah. I mean, I think there's a million answers to that question. God, I mean, my director always says that I'm like, I'm deathly serious about silliness. Yeah. I think I was about to just start talking about comedy budgets in the UK, just like destroying any lightness with admin. But I do think that like that, you know, money has been sucked out of anything that feels mm-hmm. like it's representing kind of like funniness alone in the UK. And I do think that there's something quite important about trying to stop that from being the case, because yeah. it just means that this like lovely tradition that we have it's great. You know, I mean, importance wise, when I think about like the kind of foundation of my joy growing up, 90% of it is like Father Ted,
Sacha Baron Cohen, The Office, you know, every era kind of like, it's sort of, its color palette was defined by the comedy that I was into. And I think it's important I just think as a personal mission, it feels important, you know?
So I want to talk more about creating Stath. So the earliest, at least I know of you doing the character, is on Channel 4's comedy Blaps, which was in 2013. But had you been doing the character? I know you've done live character stuff. Had you been doing a version of it before, or was it something you created for a video performance? Sort of, where was that initial origin?
I think the origin was just the voice. I think I was doing live stuff for before I got the commission. I'd been doing live stuff for like 4 or 5 years. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in that I'd sort of tried to just sort of work out what voices I can do that have whole kind of lives behind them and aren't just like sketch characters kind of thing. And growing up, meeting loads of Greek people and sort of living in a community full of loads of sort of mixed Euro English accents, and being around a lot of thick people, including myself, thick meaning stupid. I kind of, this one felt like something that I could, I'd sort of know what the character would say in any given scenario. And I do it live but I do it in various kind of, under various banners, like a guy who owns a kebab shop, a schoolboy, a guy on the phone. And then I got offered these 3 online shorts off the back of writing some sketches on spec for a sketch show on Channel 4. And we just felt like, a lettings agency was a great backdrop for this kind of 5-minute short, because it basically was just, this whole short was effectively going to be me showing someone around a property and being let to kind of like improvise and blah, blah, blah. And we just felt like it was a really funny job.
You mentioned the voice. And so between the first short you did and the 6 or 7 years until the first season, the voice changes. It sort of gets much lower. It's closer to your voice, at least in tone, in so much that the voice led so much of who the character ended up being. How did the change in voice correspond to sort of how the character evolved by the time you got to the first series?
That's a thinker. I actually, do you know what the funny thing is? I think that the development really took place in the process of shooting series 1. I mean, the voice got lower gradually over the years, because when I'd be kind of trying to demonstrate lines to my exec or my producer in the room, I just found that they'd get irritable because it was so nasal and like up here. I was like, that can sustain a short, like a 5-minute short, but 6 episodes of 23 minutes, absolutely no way. But I think the biggest development, for me as a writer, as well as Stath as a character, was I think I had a stupid rebellious streak in me that was like, why do characters have to be likable? Mm-hmm. Get over it. And it's not, and I learned that it's not about likable, it's just about interesting. And people who are loathsome aren't interesting if they have no redeeming qualities at all for the audience to hook onto. And I just did not understand that until season 1 came out. And I noticed that the general reaction to the first couple of episodes was okay, but Stath is reprehensible in it. He pushes a guy. He like isn't nice. He isn't like immediately nice to his sister. But I took for granted that the audience just knew everything that had happened in the 5 years of development. Like we'd built this like backstory for him where he was like bullied at school, et cetera, et cetera. And then like I remember people saying to me in season 1, episode 3, when you get a sense of that in like actually spoken in the story, people are like, I had no idea. So he's like a sweet guy. I'm like, isn't this like the sweet guy show? I thought that's what this was. And everyone's like, I remember my therapist saying to me, she was like, I don't know why she was watching my show and talking to me about it. But I remember her being like, what do you have against yourself that you've made this character so obnoxious? And I was like, no, I thought he was nice.
No, it's definitely a thing that I noticed from when I recommend the show that it by episode 3 and definitely by episode 4 you're like, oh, I get it. I root for this kid. I said kid because like he does, especially as the voice, the mix of sort of the voice and how he misspeaks is very sort of like a little kid. And I think,
right, yeah.
And then when you see him interact with his sister, you're just like, oh, we're watching these little kids who happen to be grown-ups. There's something really sweet about that.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, that's the aim, yeah.
The other influence that I heard you mention was how reality television stars talk. Can you talk a little bit about how that comes into play?
I think it's, Carol, the character Carol is the sort of best example of that. I think it's just like, well, I'm specifically talking about the early noughties, late 90s reality TV boom when no one had a sense of being caught out. Like everyone just thought they were getting away with everything. Mm-hmm. Like talking in a way that they've heard people talk on TV because that's the only reference point they had and not thinking people will see through it. I mean, Ricky Gervais, I've heard him talk about how he's like the original series of Pop Stars, which is what led to Pop Idol, which is what led to X Factor. Mm. I mean, David Brent is in that show. It's like, yeah. It's like literally that there's verbatim lines from The Office in that show. And it was really all about, and you know, obviously The Office was a reality TV show, in its own way. Mm-hmm. And I think it was about people, you know, being able to think that they could be funny and that people would just find them funny because they're them. And that why would anyone not find me funny kind of thing. In fact, a big sort of mission statement of mine with the show was, you know, with the sitcoms I'd watched growing up that I loved, I had noticed, a pattern of everyone saying very, very witty stuff all the time and no one's acknowledging it. And people just carry on with their day. Or at the very, I mean, when Chandler says something hilarious in Friends, at the very most, he'll get like someone like roll their eyes at him.
Yeah, that's a perfect example.
Yeah, yeah. And you're like, that he came up with that off the top of his head. That's, if that happened in my friendship group, people would talk about it for a year. It would be like, do you remember when we were sat around? There was no like, there was no jump off point. He just hit the jugular and said, maybe the funniest, smartest thing I've ever heard. And no one laughs. And I was like, okay, so what happens if you do have people laughing? And then I'm like, well, that's just like smug. And I was like, well, what if no one's funny, but everyone's laughing? And it's like, that feels more truthful to me. I think that every group of friends thinks they're the funniest group of friends in the world. They secretly want to be like, am I right in thinking that tonight was electric?
Yeah.
And we were all on the form of our lives. And it was like, if anyone was to listen in, it'd be like, it wasn't great, if I'm honest.
Yeah, I mean, in this scene, it's like Katya is like, she pretends it's a remote and she's like louder, louder, louder.
Right, yeah.
Stath is cracking up. He couldn't believe someone said something so funny.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think he's shocked by creativity. Like he's illuminated by anyone who can say something that isn't directly in front of him. Like she like her conjuring like an image of a remote. It's like, but there isn't even a remote control here. How are you doing this? I don't know. It's also like, it's nice seeing people light up.
Whenever I talk to people who do characters, I find that they are sometimes sort of extensions of people's truest selves, or the character is a sort of manifestation of something in their own personalities they wish they had. Be like, oh, they're me if I was more confident, me if I was more comfortable being angry, if I was more put together, or sort of less worried about what people think. Is Stath either is he your truest self? Is he who you'd want to be? In-
Yeah, it's my I'm aspiring every day to hit that mark. I think that he is me calling out all my flaws so that no one can say them about me. I'm not like physically skilled. Like I'm not like, I don't have a great sense of balance. I'm like, I'm not clumsy, but I was never like good at sports or anything like that. Or like a good running style. And I think that deep down, it's kind of an attempt to be like, by the way, I know and I'm leaning into it. Like, yeah. I'm making a virtue of these terrible traits of mine, kind of thing.
Yeah. In general, how well do you know Stath at this point? Like if you were asked a random question, do you feel like you instinctually like would know what he would say? Like, how deep is the backstory? Like, if I was like, oh, what's his favorite movie? Even though that's not in the show, is that something you just sort of would know?
I actually do know the answer to that question. And it's Sweeney Todd. And I think it's because it's sort of like one of 20 films he's seen. I think he probably sees himself as someone who's obsessed with films, but he's accidentally just watched the same ones over and over again. Like, just ones that he comes from one of those households where there's like four movies on the shelf, mm-hmm. and they're like his movies. And it's like, those are the ones that I watch because I have them. But I don't know. I think not due to some like deep kind of like twisted like internal relationship with him, but I think as a result of working on it almost exclusively yeah. for 8 or 9 years, I just have probably had almost every conversation I could have about him. Yeah. So maybe, yeah.
To connect it back to the scene, why was his pizza order the way that it was?
Oh, good question. Someone once said to me that the easiest, funnest scenes to write if you're ever in a hole are scenes where there's a kind of joint goal. And it usually entails ordering food, actually, mm-hmm. because it can tell you so much about each person. So I think in the instance of Stath with this, I think he sees this evening as a kind of grand sort of almost Tudor feast mixed with kind of like cool New York vibes, like things he's sort of seen on like a t-shirt in a kind of rip-off store kind of thing, like, keep doing it, man, like, we eat pizza 24/7, baby, yeah. kind of thing. And I think that he's sort of really just luxuriating in the moment, and I think he wants to sound like he knows what he's talking about, mm-hmm. And that's probably why it is. What does he say at all? What is it? He goes,
yeah.
Or is like, that not very nice at all? It's like, doesn't he say the word seems as well? It's like, this seems to have sausages and cheeses on it. I think that's him being like, I understand that the combination of food can create a delicious taste, but there's a good chance that combined incorrectly, this could be quite bad for both of us. Kind of thing. I think he's just sort of lost in the moment and just wants to say something that sounds like someone in a movie might say. But then, you know, Katia kind of actually making no sense whatsoever sounds cool to him.
Yeah.
That's sort of what that's doing. It's like the first moment where Stath might be able to look at her and see her as someone like other than just like his sister's friend who's like constantly on his tail.
Oh, because she like knows she has all these specifications what pizza she wants, and then she orders chips, which is not even on the menu.
Yeah.
Yeah. She's like, oh, wow, she's a real like a free thinker.
Yeah. I think he's like, he likes that, you know, he's very aware that this is quite new and like uncharted territory for him. But he's like, wow, this girl's eaten food before. Whoa, kind of thing.
We'll be right back with more Jamie Demetriou.
Support for this show comes from Art, Beats, and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art, Beats, and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual paths while also revealing their distinct roles within Art, Beats, and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu.
Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
We're back with Jamie Demetriou. So I've heard you talk about a lot of the development stages between the short and the series was thinking about the other characters and thinking about how they related to Stath and how each character also brought out a different things about him. So I wanted to talk about the other characters a little bit, starting with Sophie, who's played by your sister, Natasha, who sure. was also in the short, but evolves quite a bit. Can you talk yeah. about sort of her both as a singular being and as a character that relates to Steph?
Yeah. I mean, as anyone who knows her or seen her do stuff, she's unbelievable performer, always has been. I mean, we, you know, forever have been doing sort of character-y dumb stuff around the house, you know, doing impressions of our mom and dad particularly. But I think with Sophie, I was very aware that, you know, a lot of characters that Tash does in her own right, live and otherwise, are kind of loose nerve endings, mm-hmm. very kind of roof blown off kind of mad characters who are, yeah, just like, quite surreal, and I kind of didn't want to step on any of their toes kind of thing for any development that she might have. Mm. And I was like, you know, and I know a kind of much sort of quieter, sweeter side of her, obviously, and I know that she's an incredibly gifted, subtle, naturalistic actor, and I was like really keen to kind of expose that side of her, because I don't think a lot of people can do what she does in the show, like, you know, be so small and quiet, but I find her so funny in the show, and yeah. actually acts as like a, she acts as a good kind of counterbalance to Staff, because she's so sweet, like knowing that she loves him, I think helps him out mm-hmm. as far as an audience is concerned a lot. I also kind of, I don't know, I just kind of felt like it was another voice that I knew quite well, that it felt, you know, I think I knew the voice well enough to put in the show, that kind of slightly repressed, lost person who's actually sort of fine in her own way also. Mm-hmm. You know, I think she feels okay.
As you mentioned, she is the sort of the only person that is thicker or dumber than maybe Staff is.
Yeah.
I want to talk to you a little bit about the stupidity of the show, the stupidness that exists in the show, to be clear, not the stupidness of the creation of the show.
Either's fine.
Yeah. In general, what do you like about stupidity in terms of depicting it and playing it?
God, it's funny, isn't it? I don't think I knowingly do love that. I think that, strangely, it just comes naturally. I think it's just an extension of my sensibilities. I think that that's the thing that I kind of know how to do. I think that flaws allow an audience to get on side, and it allows me to get on side with the character. I kind of think that, you know, the more accessible a flaw, the more obvious a flaw, that the more lovable someone becomes, especially if they're kind of unaware of something or there's care mixed in with whatever that flaw is. I think it just allows a character more wiggle room to kind of just be. If someone kind of knows too much, I think you're more inclined to, I don't know, raise an eyebrow. Not that you're not about a character who says stuff that is so as stupid as Staff. I mean, I think ultimately I'm sort of going around in circles when the answer really is it's literally just an extension of what comes out when I try and be funny, you know?
Well, I think what is interesting, though, in your answer is there's a moment in the first series where a rival of your father points out that sort of like you can't fix someone like Staff with Staff's problems, which is... I don't know if I've seen a show that has like characters that are sort of unbelievably dumb, like so dumb that if they were in the real world, they could not like have jobs. They couldn't sort of interact, like, and it is the first time I've ever seen a show where it's like this person has a legitimate deficiency. I don't know if I remember this correctly in my developmental psychology classes, but from what I remember, younger siblings tend to pick up certain things earlier in development than the first child, essentially because they learn how to sort of talk and walk from someone who's closer in age from their older sibling. Do you like Natasha taught you how to be funny or what being funny is? Oh. Are there specific things you're like, this is so much that is so formative to me that came directly from that?
Oh, she would love me to say 100%, wouldn't she? No, I think there's a truth to that, definitely. It often felt like my favorite comedian was living in the house growing up. It's like, there's a great gig going on down the hallway. Oh, man, like, you know, but she was like a teenager when I was, you know, when I was, you know, 3 years younger than her. So she sort of, I wanted so much for her to just make me laugh all the time. My favorite game would be to take my class photo from school and get her to do impressions of how all the people in the photo sounded to her, like just from looking at her. And I think that things like that, I developed like a real love of like, just like working out in what ways everybody is stupid, I guess. And she's also really good at taking the piss out of herself and like calling herself out. But like that's the biggest competition with us, like who can call themselves out for doing the dumbest kind of thing, who can be the most confident in their own stupidity kind of thing. And I think that's, I mean, inevitably, yeah, it must be led by her.
I mean, the other thing that you've talked about is part of your sense of humor was you guys as the sort of like sounding boards for each other to sort of respond to. She called them your eccentric parents, or sort of not your not typical life growing up. Can you talk a little about what that liked and how that sort of influenced what your comedy became?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you talking about the kind of these characters not being able to kind of cope in the real world. I think that my dad kind of laid the foundation for me believing that they could. you know, the material that came out of him growing up, 99.9% of it is stuff that would get cut in kind of note stages because like they wanted the show to feel like it could exist in this universe. And I'd be like, no, that was, it was always, always, always the true stories that got cut quickest because they just felt like unfathomable. I remember him growing up being like, being on the phone to his bank and going, excuse me, I try to, every time I put my card in the machine to get the cash out, it doesn't come out. And they'd be like, did you press your PIN code? What's your PIN? And he'd be like, yeah, I pressed the numbers. Yeah. And they're like, but what? Okay, do you know what your PIN code is? And he went, yeah, it's the numbers. And they're like, but which numbers? And he went, well, whichever ones I press. And he thought that it was just like, put the card in, have a bit of fun with the numbers and the cash will come out kind of thing. And, you know, things like that would happen constantly. The amount of times I would see something insane happening in the street and then I'd get closer to it and it would turn out to be my dad. Like a guy walking down the street holding a tree. Mm-hmm. And I'd be like, oh my God, there's a guy over there holding a tree. Oh my God, he is the reason I'm alive. Like, and he would have stolen a tree from someone's garden because he thought they had olives on it and then they didn't kind of thing. So I think stuff like that, I mean, coping mechanism is probably true. Ultimately, we lived in a very loving household. You know, it wasn't devastating. It was just often quite surreal. That the ceiling on what was sort of possible was shattered most days. and I think that you would be insane to just sit and observe and then carry on with your day.
Yeah.
Not even insane. I think that I'm very lucky to have had someone there to catch their eye kind of thing. Because I think if I didn't, I would have just seen it as normality and you know, observation, being able to put words to an observation about something that happened or try to reenact something that happened. You know, I'm talking about people talking about their parents as if we were the first people to do it. Like everyone does it. Just like, but it's like, yeah. So we had this crazy thing where as siblings, we would talk to each other.
Yeah.
Inside our house. But yeah, I think that it was, you know, as Tash said, so eloquently.
I will say one thing that I was thinking about that you're similar to Seth is you sometimes call the show a family sitcom, even though like arguably it's a workplace sitcom, but because it's a family business, you've called it a family sitcom. And you know, it's similar that you, when given an opportunity to populate your work, which is this show, you've also sort of like made it a family business.
Right.
Is family how family and work and sort of your sense of self overlap? Does that feel like a way that you connect? Does that make sense to you? I also think about how like Stath really wants to have a kid in a way that you, I feel like you don't really see many characters.
I feel like it has it, the way that work and family cross over, just I don't have any connection to that theme.
Yeah.
I really don't. The child thing, I've always said that I don't necessarily feel like stereotypically Greek. Like growing up, I didn't like relate so much to the Greek side of my family. I loved them, but like I definitely felt different. I mean, my mum's English, so that's probably a big part of it. And we didn't really interact a huge amount with them as much as I'd like. But I've always felt like one of the big, sort of the two big pillars of Greekness in me is that I remember being broody really young. Mm-hmm. And seeing a kinship in that with other Greek guys my age that I found so funny. Like hearing a guy who is like simultaneously planning a kind of robbery in some instances and being like, I'll tell you what, when my daughter's born, the way in which I'm going to love her will transcend any love I've felt in my life. I just found that, you know, and I did find it, I was like, I really can't think of so many shows where that's been the case. And it felt like such an easy goal to be like, oh, that's how to make him likable as well, you know, make him be really excited about that and fill him with love for that.
So to get back to the pizza scene, why does Sophie order the pizza the way that she does, which is, can I please eat the cheese and tomato one, a Tom cheesy?
It's so nonsensical that I feel like insane trying to, but there are reasons. Sorry, this just really reminded me of, I was thinking today about doing this podcast and I assumed like stupidity and stuff would come up. Yeah. And I was like, oh, I know how I'm going to be. I'm going to be so earnest and really try and dig deep, when ultimately a lot of the time the answer probably is, I just thought it was really funny. Yeah. I did a sketch with Mr. Bean like 10 years ago as like as an essay. And I remember him doing this like really dumb thing where like it's a funeral and he's like crawling on the floor because he's left his sweets in the coffin, his candy in the coffin. And I remember him stopping because he wanted to sort of do something physically different. Yeah. And taking, he was like, and then taking this opportunity to be like, I just want to thank everybody ever so much for being here. I just can't tell you how much today has meant to me. This is a very important scene in the oeuvre of Bean. Yes, I just want to reposition my thigh as I crawl towards the coffin. Thank you ever so much. Anyway, that just brought to mind when discussing why Sophie says, yeah, I will have the tom-tom cheesy. I think she says what she says because she wants the simplest pizza and she's nervous that she might, it's more about the way she says it, and she's nervous that she might get saying a food name wrong. Mm-hmm. I think she feels like she probably doesn't deserve to be there. Oh. And I think that she's like, but simultaneously thrilled by that fact. It's like, oh my God, I'm doing a thing that someone might do in an American TV show. Like I'm like here on a date with my brother and my friend and I'm sort of setting them up and, you know, Al's here. I think she's just, I think it's, again, it's so much more about how she says it. She's she's crawling with excitement that she gets to, like, just the action of holding a menu and then saying something from it to a waiter, I think, is like one of the best moments of her year.
You mentioned Al, who's played by Al Roberts, who's a longtime friend and collaborator. Can you talk about similarly the sort of creation and evolution and sort of how he relates to both Stath and Sophie?
So Al was in the Cambridge Footlights when I was going up to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, just like the big annual comedy festival here, when we were at university at the same time, I went to a different university, but Footlights is like the most prestigious sort of comedy university group in the UK. And you know, debatably, but I'd say so. But
I'll take your word for it.
Yeah, sure. I saw him in this show and I just, he blew my mind. I just thought he was the funniest thing I'd ever seen. And continued to. He's in a sketch troupe called Sheeps with a guy called Liam Williams, a guy called Darren Johnson, who actually was the first script editor on the show about 7 years ago. And I just couldn't get enough of him. And I like, and he's kind of elusive. It's quite, we didn't socialize so much. And I think initially it was just like, I so badly want to hang out with that guy. If I write him into my show, there's a chance I might be able to, kind of thing. And just like being able to, I just wanted to bolster the show with some definites. And I was like, Al will definitely be funny if he's in it. It will just bring so much to it. I'm like, I'd be so lucky to have him. And again, similar to Sophie, I was very aware that the kind of characters that Al likes to play are often authoritative, and people around him are kind of obeisant, the joke of his characters that he does live a lot of the time is that they are kind of obnoxious and up themselves, and he doesn't realize that no one gives a shit about what he's saying. That's kind of the shtick a lot of the time. I mean, he's a brilliant character actor who play a million things, but I sort of needed a kind of Jeff in the show. I mean, Sophie gives Stath so much love, but it's kind of, you know, she's his sister. So Jeff is in Jeff from Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Got it.
To Larry, kind of. Yeah, I needed a Jeff. It's not. I wanted him to get the part so badly, but you know, the channel understandably wanted to get some names in it, so they made everyone audition. And me and Al did like a 4-hour session, just like trying to crack the character. And we worked out that the only way it was going to work is if he at no point disagreed with anything Stath said. And, you know, his kind of politeness outweighed everything. And there is kind of there's a pattern to how jokes come out of their dialogue. And more often than not with Al, it's like, Stath will say something stupid. Al will approve of the stupid thing that Stath said. Stath will pay Al like a compliment that's way too big for the advice that Al's given him. And Al will try and deflect the compliment and then sort of attempt to accept it.
You mentioned compliments. And this scene pretty early on has one where Chem says to Stath, you know, you should order as you're the best one here. The show is filled with people giving each other compliments. What do you find so funny about giving and receiving compliments?
I do find it very funny. I think it's like dumb people being earnest and being lovely. There's just something so simultaneously nice and funny about it. Like, I just think it's the kind of remedy for irony. Like just someone letting their guard down to just sort of like fill the room with love is really funny to me.
How are you at receiving compliments as a person who's having some success? Are compliments a thing that are natural for you?
I think I'm okay with it. I think I just sort of, I will either kind of just switch my brain off and say, thank you so much, that's so nice of you. Or I'll interrogate the compliment to try and find what this negative subtext is. Or, you know, natural kind of deflection. I don't know. I think it's just that it's a strange moment, isn't it? To just be told something nice. I think it's sort of unfair. It's like, not on me. It's sort of unfair that I should sort of receive that so frequently. It's like, that's too nice.
I will say, I agree with you, but I've learned that is not how a lot of people see compliments. A lot of people just like getting them.
right, maybe.
Like, they're just like normal. They're not normal like they get them all the time, but they like, oh, sometimes if you do something, you get complimented, and that's a good part of life. Where I think there are certain people who they are a peculiar thing of life that you're like, let's reckon with it with the TV show that has people constantly have compliments being given.
Right, yeah, that makes sense to me.
To talking about Sophie and Al, my colleague Catherine Van Arendonk compared the show to The Office in a piece on Vulture recently, and in many ways, at least to me, tonally and comedically, it reminds me more of The American Office, just because it's like a little bit sweeter. Considering how huge that show was growing up, there's no way for it to sort of not have shaped like what you thought a sitcom could and should be like. But how much was it an organic influence, and how much it was you intentionally iterating on, well, this is sort of like the sort of sitcom in people's brains. I don't want to subvert it or try to do things that are playing against it.
I think entirely organic. I don't think there's any point in which I sit down and say, how can I do what The Office did? I just want the show to be as funny as it can be. And I think, ultimately the thing that was so original about The Office probably wasn't the kind of the structure of like 2.1 characters in the center and then like a sort of overseer, and then there are so many parallels that are drawn that I can draw myself so easily, but I don't think any of them were intentional, actually. No, I think that it even took me a while to realize that I'd accidentally made a show in an office. Yeah. Because in my head it was like it's a lettings agency, he's in a car, or yeah, like he's in apartments. And then it was like, oh, we should probably house this somewhere. Well, let's give them like a base, and most of the show will take place out and about. And then eventually you're like, oh, they're spending a lot of time in an office, like that show, The Office. And it's like, oh, and there's a sort of heterosexual love story at the front of it, and a buffoon that's kind of like overseeing everything. Oh, and like a couple of people that you need to make the buffoon like not seem too reprehensible, blah, blah, blah. And then someone who rolls their eyes kind of thing. I mean, I think, you know, it just happens. And I think it happens because I think The Office just did everything right. And yeah, you kind of go, well, what feels right now? And naturally you're like, you're just led to these kind of pillars that seem to work. I mean, funnily enough, I think that at the very, very beginning, a big decision we had to make, just on sort of office comparisons, a big decision we had to make was whether or not to make it mockumentary, because it was around the time that it was like booming. And the production company that make a show called People Just Do Nothing, which is a really successful mockumentary here that's good. And you know, it was like a big question about like, should we utilize that, this mode that allows you to deliver exposition in a talking head so that you can just focus on the funnies and in the scenes. And the decision came down to two things. I think one was, I want the characters to be alone from time to time. Like, I want the comedy to not come out of bravado. And I think I want there to be a joke that, you know, I want there to occasionally be bravado that's drawn out by things other than there being a camera there. Mm-hmm. Like, I want the characters to be like literally by themselves in a room sometimes and see what that's, you know, what that brings out. But also, I just wanted to challenge myself to work out how to write exposition into dialogue in scenes between people. And not that you don't do that in a mockumentary, but I know myself, and I reckon I would have probably lent too heavily on that as a device and ended up not really coming out the other side of it I think that I probably didn't make it a mockumentary because I wanted so much to make it a mockumentary, like for the wrong reasons kind of thing.
Yeah. It's like, oh, that'd be easier. And I don't want it to be easier.
Yeah. I think ultimately, yeah.
So back to the pizza scene. Why does Al order the way he does?
Because he wants to impress Sophie, or kind of, he wants to show her that he's like her, and that they get on really well, and that they might, you know, it's more structural, his answer in this instance, because he wants to share a pizza with her kind of thing. But he obviously hasn't thought it through, because He doesn't understand that ordering the same thing as something someone is the only reason why you wouldn't want to share with them.
Yeah. So the other main character in the scene is Katya, who's played by Ellie White, who you also have known, who also works quite a bit with your sister. They're double act partners. So it's the same question, but I also I think in an interview in the past you described Stath as sort of asexual and innocent. How Katya does not have that energy. She calls him sexy. She seems to have a more grown up understanding of what the relationship should be. Talk to me both about sort of creating Katya and what does it mean to introduce a person like Katya to a character like Stath?
Okay. I mean, again, like Al, it was like, how do we just raise the bar on how funny this is? And Ellie is like one of the funniest people in the world to me. And, you know, we all have kind of a shorthand, and having that in a show is just invaluable. Like someone that you can just throw to like that and give new stuff, and just they know exactly what you mean when you're saying it. As far as Katya as a character is concerned, again, I think that Stath is such a piece of shit in so many ways that it's useful to have as many like people liking him as possible, because it's, you know, Stath has the or not thinking he's an idiot as possible, because he has all the viewers, all these other people, the entire audience watching the show thinking this guy's stupid. So it was like, what if someone finds him sexy? And also like, what kind of person would find him sexy? And you go, well, someone who probably has no taste and sort of like sees a kind of like a football player in a fairground mirror. Like that's sort of, I think, how she sees him. It's like he has an earring and he has a suit and he has leather shoes and like says stuff from films, and she doesn't see through any of that. I think she just takes it all at face value. And I think that it says something about Stath that the one person who's giving him that kind of stuff, he rejects. And I think it's probably because he sees a bit of himself in her that he doesn't know about himself, kind of thing. He's like, no, she's like tacky, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Like, as in like, there's some, in fact, I think the main thing with him is that he sees her as like very foreign, while he doesn't realize that he is probably more foreign than she is, kind of thing. And I think that he probably, you know, there's a duality with Stath, which is that he probably wishes he was an English gentleman deep down, but is simultaneously really proud of being Greek. But I don't think he knows what either of them means. I think growing up, I struggled a lot with kind of that, knowing, like, I could see that, like, there was loads of funny Euro stuff. Like, I'd go to Cyprus and you'd watch a sitcom and it would just be like a guy like falling over 1,000 times in half an hour. Or like, I remember seeing a prank show over there that was just like canned laughter without pause, just canned laughter from beginning to end. And a guy walking down the street, this was the prank. There's a guy walking down the street holding three big boxes, struggling to carry them. And like, wah, 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 was like playing over the top. And they're catching, you got the laughter going, and they're catching people's eyes as they pass him, but they're nonplussed by it. They don't care. They don't care that he's doing it. It was just like so lacking in quality. I remember watching a sitcom where instead of windows in the studio, they had like glossy posters of windows. So I was very aware of all that stuff and found it really funny. But then I sort of struggled with this idea of like, but how am I connected to that if I find it so funny? And I think as I've grown up, I only love it. I think it's like so, I love that it's so throwaway, and I love that it's like, oh, fucking give a shit about this TV program. I want to go and have some like delicious dinner and talk to my family, kind of thing.
You mentioned the sort of certain physical humor that you watch, and it's not in the scene and it's hard to really depict on audio. I do want to at least talk a little bit about physical comedy for people who have watched the show and will. A type of thing that you do, I think, 3 or 4 times, which is like a series of a physical comedy act where there's the soccer ball, when you score a goal on your own net thing, spoiler alert, the energy drink, the keys, I think the keys is my favorite one. So how do you approach sort of physical comedy? How do you sort of conceive the ones that are sort of these like edited runs?
I suppose I think it's just about, I think you're just led by like what would make me gutturally laugh. Yeah. Not laugh because it's like, oh, a man's falling over, full stop. It's like, what's the kind of, what's the friction in the slapstick? Like what's happening in the story that makes it funny? And it's like in the instance of him throwing the keys, I suppose the joke is less about the physical comedy, but more that it's his version of what he saw in the, earlier in the episode. You see his boss is like really slick, kind of sexy advert for the letting agency, and he's trying to do his own version of that, and it's like why is your version of that so violent? You know, I think that was the question that made me laugh. Like in his head he's like, right, so I suppose he's sort of dancing with that girl and getting in the shower and like he's chucking keys to a mate and this mate's catching them. I suppose it's the same thing as me throwing keys at Al's head and holding on to a chandelier and stuff like that. I think that the joke has to be more than just like someone falls over. It has to be built in. I mean, that's so obvious, but yeah.
The other physical thing I want to ask you about is the clothes. They're incredibly specific. I mean, especially Stat's clothes and Sophie's clothes. Talk about your approach to them, because they feel so deliberate, and it's hard to sort of, as an outsider, to put your finger on it. How do you think of them, and why do they make such sense? You're like, they fill out those characters so much more.
Thanks. By the way, any question you're asking me that has a compliment in it, thank you very much.
No problem.
With Sophie, I sort of, it's a combination of like a deep comfort mixed with a lack of aspiration. Mm. I suppose she's like, she doesn't want to get dressed up or anything like that because she doesn't think that anyone would care. Probably she's never thought that anyone would care, kind of thing, which is kind of a comfort thing, but it's the clothes are literally comfortable. I wanted her to be like, yeah, of course I'm going to wear the thing that's comfiest, otherwise I'll be uncomfortable. There's an element of like hiding there as well. I've always thought that you know, those were given to her by someone significant a long time ago, and she's just never thought to mix it up because that's not how her mind works. It's all quite linear for her. It's just like, I want to be a musician and I'm going to do it probably. And I don't need to do anything in the meantime to get me there. Like, I'll just stay the same and then I'll be a musician, kind of thing. With Stath and the other characters, it was really, it's sort of like, what does he... what's the kind of like shit version? What's the version that he can afford of what he thinks is cool, kind of thing? Like what, like, I think again, it's like it's always the bare minimum and this assumption that like, well, it's what I want, so it's what will be. It's like, well, I want this suit to be the coolest suit in London, so it probably is. Like I think I get that from my dad. Like if I was to like ask for a birthday cake from him, he'd be like, all right, I'll get you. And I'll be like, chocolate. And he'd be like, yeah, birthday cake, chocolate birthday cake. And it would come and it wouldn't be chocolate. It would just be brown. And I'd be like, I'd be like, oh, this isn't chocolate. He'd be like, it is. And he's a chef.
Yeah.
And he'd taste it and be like, yeah, that's chocolate, because why wouldn't it be? It'd be really inconvenient if it wasn't, because that would mean that I was wrong.
Yeah.
And I think that Stath's clothes are born out of that. And then, you know, all the other characters, it is just like, it's a big part of it is just like, what can these people afford? And ultimately, very few of them, I think Carol's probably the only person in the office who dreamed of being a letting agent. And her clothes do seem more kind of chosen, I think. I think she wants to look nice, whereas everyone else is just like, I need a suit to be a letting agent, so I will buy the first suit that I see in a shop.
So, you know, we talked about a little bit, you feel like the name Stath Let's Flats probably was not the best decision in so much as if you ever wanted to make sense for Americans, it wouldn't. I mean, like, I know when I saw the title, none of the words immediately made clear what the show was. But I yeah. did watch it, and I persevered. And
thank
it's,
you.
So, but so it's clear that the States as an idea has been on your radar for some time. And, you know, of course, in recent years, your sister's has gotten a good deal of acclaim for her role in What We Do in the Shadows. As it relates to being a comedian, how do you feel about America and what informed that feeling?
I think I do look to America as far as quality is concerned. I think that a lot of the time, and, you know, so many Americans I talk to have said the same thing. I don't know, just out of politeness. But I think that there's like, I think that that's just the result of like, you probably won't see our worst stuff because it won't reach there kind of thing, and vice versa kind of, you know. So, yeah, I kind of, it seems like a magical other place to me. You know, I look at like my, you know, I love Kate Berlant and John Early and that gang, and I think they're incredible. And that to me seems like a, you know, a super high bar to be reached, and any kind of, you know, I don't know, it just sort of having the show be like even on over there and like part of any kind of conversation, no matter how small, is, yeah, I'm really, it's really, really nice. It's really, it's that sort of, that's it. I just, I'm just like, it feels great. I'm really thrilled, especially with the fucking title. I mean, we were going to call it Staff, just Staff. And it felt like dead. It just felt like nothing.
Yeah.
And we spoke about it for a while, and we suggested Staff Let's Flat to the beginning, and it got vetoed so hard. And then it came around to releasing it, and the channel were like, ah, I don't know about Staff. And then we talked about calling it Agent Staff. And then we were like, this isn't solving the Staff problem. And somehow, it became Staff Let's Flat. And I stand by it 25% because I do find it funny how obtuse it is. And I find it funny that the name of the show is Staff's answer to the question, what do you do for a living? Staff, let's flats. I let flats. And I think that, yeah, if I had my time again, sure, I'd change it. I don't know what to. I think about it all the time. I don't know what. Do you have any suggestions? Because I'm happy to put it in the mix.
You could do stent. I mean, I'm trying to think if you Americanized the words just for the title, but then still had them say letting agencies, and then like if it was Staff Rents Flats, let's say. But you don't really use rents in that way. I think that's part of the hard thing is it does seem like how renting and letting works is a little bit different.
Like, right.
Because it's letting, like we have brokers who are just there for the sort of like getting people apartments and then they're done, right? And they don't work for the apartment, where it seems like you guys are both letting and managing.
Yeah, property management. Most sort of crummy lettings agencies in the UK will say lettings and property management. So yeah, that's how that works. So again, yeah, so the culture is like, the culture's so different in so many ways. Ultimately, there is probably a title out there, but we fucked it and it's done, and I just sort of have to accept it. And that, I think I really, really had given up on the idea of, it just had never occurred to me that it might work over there. And also, you know, it's such a local show. Like the voice is so specific to our part of town. So like even being asked on a show like this is like, it, you know, it's so lovely that anyone's kind of into it over there.
I don't watch a lot of British things, partly because I decided it's too much to have to learn about, and I'm like, if I have to watch one thing, I have to watch like 100 of it. And then this, people really recommending, and I'm of a belief that like things are local and it's good because it's specific, but there's some, it works. It reminded me, have you ever watched the show Detroiters? Did that make it out there?
I have, I love those guys, they're amazing.
That was like the closest, because they're sort of like, this is a small business that I imagine is the equivalent of like the people that do local commercials, but it's ultimately a show about like sweet people that work together, and they're like just like the excuse to be able to be nice to each other.
Yeah, there's definitely that kinship. In fact, actually, the guy who Andrew Gaynord, who directed the original Blaps short, actually directed a couple of episodes of Detroiters and Tim's Netflix special.
Oh wow.
So there's a link there. But I God, those guys are so funny. And yeah, there's a similarity there. Never thought of that. Yeah, Detroit is so funny.
Assuming we'll be in a time where you can fly more readily again in the future, is a career in America a thing as you've now have an amount of success as the show plays here, as I imagine, you know, you take more meetings with more LA types. Is it a thing that you aspire to? And what would that what is behind that aspiration?
Sure. Yeah, I think it's something I aspire to. There's a couple of things on the horizon, I think. I mean, ultimately, I think that staff will always be kind of second tier as far as meetings and stuff are concerned to Fleabag, which is fine by me. Like every meeting I've gone into for the past few years in the States, it's like, it's just been such an amazing gift for me because, you know, having a point of reference is everything. And the point of reference to be that, you know, amazing thing that Phoebe created it's like a real stroke of luck for me, you know, because those kind of like two episode parts, they very rarely do a huge amount for you.
Yeah.
So ultimately, yeah, that's part of that. That was the kind of kickoff for American work. And I've done a couple of things in the States, but I think the reason behind the one is just growth and expansion. Mm-hmm. I suppose you want to work with different people, do different things, kind of like, just again, it's the same as choosing the possibly less easy for me option with staff. It's like, it really scares me, the prospect of going out there and trying to work out a kind of more universal sensibility or not, you know, maybe sticking to my guns and working out how I can make that work on the ground over there. And I just think it feels like a challenge. I think most Brits would agree. It's kind of like it's like, why not? Let's expand, I guess.
So that sound means it's time for our final segment, which is the laughing round. It's like a lightning round, but because this is comedy, it's a laughing round.
Great.
Do you have a favorite joke?
Oh, do I? A friend of mine, Liam Williams, used to open his set with the joke, the universe implodes, no matter, which I thought was nice. that's the one that rings off the top of my head.
Yeah, it's nice.
Yeah.
It's a more, I feel like American street jokes have like big ramp ups for nothing. And I think British ones are sort of more coy. So I like that one.
Yeah, I think it's more representative of that. There's definitely sort of bigger ramp up ones that I have, but weirdly not to hand.
As I mentioned, I don't tend to have many British guests on, but people always say I should. So in your opinion, who are at max three British comedians that I should interview?
Okay. Whoa. Okay. I'm sort of going through my head like all right, okay, let's just take everyone in staff as a given. Like that is my gang. Like I love those. So Daisy May Cooper and Charlie Cooper are hysterical. They make a show called This Country on BBC Three that I love. Christ, that's two. And then let's just knock it out the park with the last one. Who's the funniest? Oh, Tim Key. Yeah.
Great.
He's a comedian and poet who is, I think by all accounts, one of the funniest people in the universe. So yeah.
Is there I often ask if there's a joke you wish you could steal, or a character, or is there a sketch? Is there any sort of comedic unit that you've seen another person do that you saw and you wish, I wish I thought of that, or I wish I could do that, something to that effect?
Let me think. Lately, this show, This Country, there's an amazing episode where they just sit on a train platform And the whole episode just takes place with them sat on this bench, just talking to each other. And I would love to work out how to like make like the deepest bottle episode imaginable. I love the idea of really knowing how to have faith in like the tiny kind of thing. So yeah, I think that that's again the one that springs to mind.
It seems that you are very into at least singing R&B ballads.
Yeah.
Do you have a
yeah, obviously.
What is your favorite one to sing? What is your favorite one? Anything what is the R&B ballad that comes to mind when I brought up this question?
Four Seasons of Loneliness by Boyz II Men is stunning. Yeah.
And this will be the last one. Do you have a joke or a bit or a character that you did an amount of times and the audience never liked it and you kept on trying and they kept on not liking it and maybe you've given it up, but you'll go to your grave being like, that character was so funny and the audience was wrong the entire time?
Let me think. I did a character who had varying success called Michael Eggwater, who was a guy who was trying to get his daughter back. His estranged daughter had come to see him do a show, and I would like annihilate myself on stage every night, because the joke was he just keeps really badly hurting himself while he's trying to impress this estranged daughter, to the point that I had to go to hospital because I'd like fractured my heel. And it just the kind of the fact that it wasn't getting laughs and I was getting so hurt, just it made me feel more and more like I needed to continue doing it, because it was like, I was like, I need at some point or another to get something out of this pain. And, you know, it kind of started to go well occasionally, but I definitely had some of my worst ever gigs doing that. I remember doing a show as him. It was in a huge venue. It was like a competitive stand-up comedy night, the Leicester Square Comedy Awards. And I did like a 5-minute set, and it got so my girlfriend was there to support me at the time. And she was sat on a balcony, like on the top right. And I remember any time she laughed in support, the sound of everyone's necks in the audience craning to her to see what she might have been finding funny was louder than her laugh. Just this like, woof. Like, and it was like they were like, she must be watching something funny on her phone or something, because there's clearly no comedy going on in the room right now.
It's like she was interrupting their silence.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, excuse me. Yeah, so that springs to mind, yeah.
That is perfect. That's it. That's the end of the interview.
Oh, cool.
Thank you so much. This was fantastic.
Oh, yeah? Thanks, man. I'm never quite sure on podcasts, so thanks very much.
I think you're quite good at it. I feel like I've heard you say that, and you are, other than you thinking you didn't do well, you do quite a good job explaining all this stuff.
Oh, that's very nice. I think it's more just about I find it quite difficult being myself. I think it's like, if people don't like a character, I can easily sort of rationalize that. But if someone doesn't like me, I'm like, ah! So yeah, interesting.
That's it for another episode of Good One. You can watch Thathlet's Flats on HBO Max. Follow Jamie on Twitter, @JamieTonight, and on Instagram, @JamieDemetriou. Good One is produced by myself, Jelani Carter, Hannah Rosen, and Camila Salazar. Gautam Srikishan did our theme song. Write a review and rate the show on Apple Podcasts. 5 stars, please. Email any comments, questions, or laughing around suggestions to goodonepodcast@gmail.com or tweet at us @GoodOnePodcast. I'm Jesse David Fox, and you can follow me @JesseDavidFox. Good One is a production of Vulture and the Vox Media Podcast Network. We'll be back next week with a new comedian and a new joke. Have a good one. Every time someone says have a good one to me, I'm like, they must be a fan. But it happens literally all the time. And every time I'm like, do they know?
Support for this show comes from Art, Beats, and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative, along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art, Beats, and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art, Beats, and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari, W., and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour,
captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.